I mean, it's a heart attack of a show, truly. Oh, and not because of the food.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, welcome. I'm really excited about this show, so thanks for joining us. So for a while now, I've been planning on doing deep dive review episodes more regularly here on Pop Culture Confidential. And we're starting with a great show, the surprise hit of the summer, The Bear. Joining me for this deep dive is a guest I've been looking forward to having on the show for a long time. Let me introduce him. He is the editor-in-chief of the excellent Entertainment Awards website, Next Best Picture. He has a must-listen podcast featuring a great team of critics. He is a fellow member of the Critics' Choice, and we share a home at the Evergreen Podcast Network, Matt Neglia. Thanks so much for joining me, and finally we meet.
Well, thank you, Christina, for having me. I know this has been a long time coming, and I've been wanting to come on this show and speak with you for quite some time. And I'm just glad that we're finally here to talk about one of the hottest, most exciting new shows of 2022.
Great. Let's get started. So just for some context, to be honest with you, Matt, I had not heard of The Bear before June. I mean, I'd hardly heard of the creator, Christopher Storer. But in LA this summer, you could just tell people were buzzing about this show, even though this was sort of the time when the Emmy nominations for this year were being talked about and a bunch of FYCs were going on. But everyone was talking about The Bear. So finally, I said, I have to watch it. And when I did, I could not stop. And I can't wait to talk to you about it because the buzz has been even more the past month. For the audience, this is going to be a show full of spoilers, and we're going to be discussing plot lines, which you probably won't know anything about if you haven't seen it. So if you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, you probably want to do so before you listen. On FX Hulu and on Disney Plus and other territories, I believe. Like, it's starting to roll out now in Canada on August 3rd and continuing on. So briefly about The Bear, it's essentially about Carmen, Carmy, played by Jeremy Allen White, who we all know from Shameless. He's a young chef from the world of fine dining, but when we meet him, he's come back home to Chicago to run his family's Italian beef sandwich shop. He's working through the grief of his brother Mikey's suicide, who used to own the restaurant. Other characters include Sydney, played by Ayo Edebiri, an ambitious young chef who starts working there, as well as Richie, played by Evan Moss Bacharach. They call each other cousin, even though they really aren't. And Richie is not particularly happy with the changes coming to the restaurant.
This is your brother's house. I was running it fine without you.
Why didn't he leave it to you then? Don't wipe your hands on your apron, chef.
Jeff! I refer to everybody as chef because it's a sign of respect.
You can throw down, huh?
Behind.
So how you gonna pass the family test? Delicious or impressive?
Delicious is impressive.
Word.
Yo, family's up.
I just never had platanos with, like, grass on
it. We want to change this restaurant, right? But we have to change the chemistry.
Chicago. Why are you always, like, watching me?
Because it's just sort of my job.
We're in a chili place. Because it organizes, it's more confusing.
Right there. Labeled chili flakes.
This is a delicate ecosystem, and it's held together by a shared history and love.
I have every intention of turning this into a respectable place of business. Eventually.
All right, Matt, let's just start with your general thoughts on the series.
Yeah, so as I said before, this is one of the hottest, exciting new shows on television today. And like you, I was not aware of The Bear when it first initially aired. And I found out about it a little bit later in the summer. I believe it was around the time the second season got renewed. So like 2 weeks into July. But the good thing that happened was that all the episodes were available right away. And I think this just allowed for everybody to, in a very, very, very short period of time, to watch this show. And the fact that they're very short episodes, under an hour long, I think they range from like 20 to 45 minutes, it was something that people could get through pretty quickly and be able to, in totality, summarize very, very explicitly how great this show is. And so you heard a lot of people, like you said, buzzing about it in person or online. And so I took the plunge and I checked it out. And I normally don't do this because for me, I'm usually scared of watching a show in its early stages out of fear of it being canceled. I would rather wait to see that it's more established before I allow myself to get emotionally invested. But
that's self-care, Matt. You're so
exactly. But I figured, you know what? 8 episodes, half an hour roundabout, you know, I can knock this out in 4 hours, you know, pretty much an evening. It took me 2 nights to watch the whole thing, but man, I've heard this said a lot, and I know that this comparison is becoming quite tired, but this is honestly very truthful. It's Uncut Gems in a kitchen. I say tired because everybody likes to say this is the new Uncut Gems, et cetera, et cetera. But this really is the case here with this particular show. It is hyperkinetic in terms of its camera work, its editing. The cast is also equally electric as well. There's a very, very exciting, fresh group of new faces surrounding Jeremy Allen White, who everybody probably knows from Shameless, I imagine. And so there's something about this that just feels not only very raw and exciting, but also, too, as someone who used to work in the restaurant business a couple of years ago when I was, you know, younger, dare I say, extremely authentic to how it captures just the day-to-day of running a restaurant business, and especially at the level that Carmy wants to bring it to. So this show is phenomenal, and I definitely have more to talk about, which I'm sure we'll get into in a little bit here, but I'll summarize it by that by saying it's definitely one of the best shows I have seen not only this year, but I really do believe, like, deep down in my heart, that it's a show that will endure a whole cycle of another year, hopefully in time for next year's Emmy Award season.
Yes. I was thinking it's kind of like if Bourdain's Kitchen Confidentials was rewritten by Eugene O'Neill with a little bit of Puzo in there. I think this triangle, Carmy, Richie, and the dead brother Mikey, are so powerful. These themes about returning home when you just wanted to get out of there, living up to the ghost of the brother or friend who died, the addiction themes and codependency. I just think it's so rich. I know this sounds highfalutin, but I was thinking of sort of Carmy and his brother Mikey. They're like characters out of East of Eden, or remember Paris, Texas?
Yeah.
And there's even some Salieri and Amadeus in there with the brother who leaves and who's much better than the other one. Elements of Fredo. And I think my favorite character of them all is Richie, Yvonne.
Interesting.
Moss-Bacharach. Yeah, and I can tell you why quickly. I think character, he's like the nostalgic character. He lived his glory days when Carmy's brother Mikey was alive. He seems to have been part of this family since they were kids, but he's always in trouble, and he's always, he wants those glory days back. He's so cautious of change, and when Sydney and Carmy want to do new things to the restaurant, he's the one who gets really tense about that. But at the same time, there are these fantastic scenes, like when you see him at the front of the store and he's talking to customers coming in. He's so good at that. He knows everyone's name, everyone's kid's name. He's like salt of the earth.
See, I found Richie to be a frustrating character. And I cannot say that I know, and I can't say that I've warmed up to him, because I haven't still. I admire that the show does peel back the layers on him a bit more, and there is this like deep-rooted anger and sadness to honestly how pathetic his character can be sometimes. But he's the type of character that you always point at the obstacles that are hindering, like, the other characters in the show, and you notice that they're stemming from this one other character. And if this one other character would just get it together and would just fall in line, do as he's told, and not let his ego get in the way of what it is that he and Carmi are trying to accomplish, they could do great things, but he just always finds a way to mess everything up. And God, it's frustrating.
Yeah, but that's the brilliance of it. I mean, how would we have seen The Godfather and all these casts of characters if there weren't brothers who just like, my God, what did you just do?
I give Ibn Moss Backrack like all the credit in the world, though, for me to feel something for that character by the time we got to the end of the season, because man, there, I wanted him to get stabbed in the side. I
me too. Like,
that was how much I loathed him. So credit to him for really just making that character three-dimensional and human.
Just because he is so frustrating, and just because he, I mean, for example, there's scenes where they show you how diplomatic Sydney is, for example, when there's this kerfuffle outside the restaurant. She's there giving them sandwiches and being very diplomatic. He's looking for his gun. I mean, he can't handle things like that. But when you get to the scene where Carmi bails him out from jail and mm-hmm. he's sitting in the car and he just quietly says, "You're all I have."
Yeah.
If he wouldn't have been that frustrating and if we wouldn't have had that sort of narrative line, I don't think I would have felt. Backrack just nails that, you know, that feeling you have of just please get yourself together. But at the same time, you have all this compassion for him. I think that's just brilliant writing and acting.
Yeah, I was really blown away by it. It has a quality to it that is very, very rare in most shows, where the writing for the characters, you know, a lot of times these big reveals or even subtle reveals into what makes these characters tick and reveal their true nature, they usually unfold over the course of many seasons. And this show unpacked so much in such a short period of time. And that's why I think The Bear is resonating with people, is that you said it before, it's very rich for the short runtime that it has. It gives you so much in regards to understanding these characters' motivations, understanding how they work together, understanding what drives them apart. And that's like something that I found to be just very invigorating, was seeing how cool it is when you have all these people working together. Look what they can accomplish when they do, use the system. They develop the system in the kitchen, you know, they call it. And Carmi, you know, almost like a military drill sergeant, really is able to get everyone to understand their role, know their positions, and then execute with efficiency. So that's why, like with Richie, it's very, very frustrating, because it's like you only have one job, sir. Man the cash register, be the face of the restaurant with the customers. You said it before, like he's the kind of guy that knows everybody in town. Everybody in town knows him. So he's perfect for that. Mm-hmm. Why are you getting involved outside of that? And God, it's very frustrating. But that's the source of conflict, you know, and that's really good, I think. So,
and in the same way, his, you know, Carmi's sister, she has that relationship to Carmi where she, you know, she's trying to live another life. She's trying to, you know, get things together and is worried about the taxes. And there's also this line where she looks at her brother and after they've had this big fight and she just says, "Will you come back and fight with me tomorrow?" She sort of realizes that that's the love they have. That's the relationship that these people have in the Found family and in the family. They're just going to be like this. You're not mm-hmm. going to be able to change them all that much. And the small ways that Carmi comes in, Sydney, she wants to change the restaurant immediately. She's brilliant and impatient. And he knows that he can't do that with Richie. He can't do that with the customers. You have to take it slow. And I think that is such an interesting how they know each other while at the same time they're so frustrating.
It's really frustrating because, you know, Richie is family to Carmi, and you know, you can see very clearly how life would be so much better working alongside Sydney as partners in this endeavor. And there's a shared history between Carmi and Richie that even it's really tough because I think about this a lot, actually, like, you know, when you have friends or family members who fuck up and you always end up forgiving them, giving them second chances because essentially they're blood in literal and figurative senses. And so I go back and forth on that a lot because I'm the kind of person that after you know, a few times, I tend to cut people off, you know? So like, I wouldn't put up with Richie if I was Carmi, but the fact that he does just, I think, shows the level of depth that there is to their relationship connected through Mikey, who is played in these very, very brief snippets by John Bernthal. Mm-hmm. And I actually thought that was pretty brilliant casting because John Bernthal is like one of the most likable people right now working today, I feel like. And I know that a lot of times he's cast in roles where he's a tough bad guy or things like that. But then sometimes you see him in a movie or a show where he's exuding so much warmth and charisma. And yes, he is like a macho like type of man in a lot of ways, but it's the kind of giant big teddy bear that you want to have hanging around to give a hug to every now and then. And I really, really love the dynamic that they showed in his very, very brief scenes because Mikey's alluded to a lot throughout the show. And so even though John Bernthal comes on screen and it's, you know, it runs the risk of us getting taken out of the moment because it's him, you know, and so we would be distracted by the fact that it was John Bernthal. But he, in a very, very short amount of time, exhibits all the qualities that we've heard about Mikey and then brings it all to life in a way that makes every single scene where Carmi and Richie are talking about him and referring to that shared history land that much more effectively.
Oh, I completely agree. I think this is a stroke of brilliant casting for exactly the reason you're saying and for what we were talking about at the beginning. Mikey represents so much to them. I mean, he's Richie's whole life. They had their glory days together. You have his little brother Carmi, who for the whole series until he gets that letter, all he wanted from his brother was for him to be proud of him. He wanted him to say this. He was, you know, saddled with his addiction, and he left, feels guilty for leaving those years. In order to have this presence when he's dead for us, the viewers, to have Bernthal, as you say, this incredibly charismatic actor who you feel just immediately connected to, even if you only see him in a 1 minute scene, I just think that was brilliant. It could have just fallen flat with someone else because he represents that, what I was saying, you know, the great stories and books about that family member, friend, brother who just is a ghost hanging over your family, and you have to sort of break free of those reins. And I thought he was just incredible casting.
Yeah, definitely agreed. And, you know, they do a good job, too, of leveraging some of the other guest stars as well. Like Joel McHale shows up as Carmi's former boss at the restaurant that he used to be at in New York City. And he's very effective in his brief scene. I actually wanted to see more of him, and I hope we kind of get to do. I would like to see flashbacks to Carmi's time of working in a 5-star restaurant in New York. I think that would be actually a lot of fun to see what other experiences he might have had that impact how he makes decisions today. But also too, Molly Ringwald also is a guest star in the show as well.
Yeah, like a couple minutes only.
Yeah, yeah. Like these are very, very short but extremely effective usage of guest actors in a television show. And the show, as we mentioned before, is very short to begin with. So I find there to be just this really incredible efficiency of storytelling at play here, where the bear is like the meat that they're selling, incredibly lean. And there's no fat.
It's the simplest pasta. It's just that tomato, onion, and mozzarella, and that's it. No unnecessary anything.
Nah, you got it. You're hitting the nail right on the head there. And I think that a lot of that is also attributed to the editing of the show and how well it moves. I knew right away in the very beginning when I saw how quickly edited it was, but also not in a distracting sense, but in a controlled, chaotic sort of way. And that's very much what working in a restaurant is. It's controlled chaos. And so for the editing to match that feeling, that I thought was a really cool stylistic decision that carries on through the show. It's not like Adam McKay style of cutting, it has...
Exactly.
But I am going to go back to the Uncut Gems comparison again, because you have people talking over each other. You then have these inserts of flashes of the city and the environment and other elements too of close-ups of the like extreme close-ups of like cracking of eggs on a stove, or you know, the pieces of kitchenware that they're using to, you know, make whatever it is that they're making, and so on and so forth. It's really, really tight. It's just a really, really tight show. I never, not once while watching this, felt like it ever dragged. There was not a single episode that I could point at and say, oh, that was a bad episode, take that one out. Mm-hmm. In fact, I actually think, going back to what we were saying before, dropping all of this on Hulu to where every episode was available, you don't have to watch it week by week, I think is the best way to watch this show, because I think if I was watching it week by week, and I feel this way sometimes with Barry, it's too short. And it's like, oh my God, like, yes, there's the idea of leave them wanting more, but The Bear functions in a sort of way where it doesn't feel episodic with the exception of one episode in particular, which I'm sure we'll get to in a second here, but it feels very cohesive. It feels like it's all part of a whole, and it is a story, a self-contained story in this one season with a beginning, middle, and end throughout its entire episodic structure.
One of the reasons I think it's because they're so excellent at not having unnecessary exposition.
Yeah.
It's on a need-to-know basis, Matt. We don't go into anyone's apartment unnecessarily. There's no cutesy visits from Richie's daughter. We only hear her on the telephone. We see what we have to see. We don't have to get the backstory when we need the backstory. We know just enough about Mikey, John Barenthal. That I think they've been so effective with the exposition and with those things on the side. And as you were saying, the little clips of Chicago, some stark black and white opening credits once, where mm-hmm. you get some historical footage and puts into context where this restaurant is, but we don't have some big long thing about, you know, this family. And you get it. They really give the audience credit in order to lift the story of these great diverse group of characters. We haven't even talked about the rest of the characters in the kitchen who seem so incredibly well put together, like the found family that they're playing.
I mean, Sydney and Marcus have a scene together at, I believe it's Sydney's apartment
in the finale. Yeah.
Yep. And I was almost like taken aback by it, because I was like, wow, we're following these characters outside of the kitchen without Carmi or Richie right now. And I was like, whoa. You
know? I know, because it's the only time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except for when she's in bed. There's a few scenes in the when she's gets ready in the morning and leaves her apartment. But
yeah, but those are so fleeting. Like, this was a long scene of dialogue between two characters that, you know, at this point we've gotten to know fairly well. So I do think there is something to what you're saying here and how the show... It feels like almost like the show has like these established rules that it wants to follow throughout the course of the show. What did you think? I'm curious about this, because by the time you get to the end of the show, we know why the show is called The Bear, mm-hmm. which I kind of saw coming. It didn't take me long to realize that that was what the title's purpose was ultimately going to be. But I'm watching episode one and I'm watching Jeremy Allen White stare down a CGI bear. And I'm saying to myself, oh boy, what is this? This is silly. What are we doing here? They somehow managed to take something that on the surface seemed initially pointless and silly at first,
and thematically tie it in to the themes of the show in such a way, and also to Carmi's character, that I, by the end, I just found it to be such a masterstroke of brilliance.
So Christopher Storr, I don't think he has been created anything. He's mainly been a producer to some of excellent things. Rami and Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade. This was intended to be a movie, but then it became, after many, many years, it became a series. His sister, Courtney, she's a Don't you know that you're
a grown-up? I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But, you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com. Life sucks as a grown-up. All right, I think that was good enough.
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right.
I've never done it.
Right. Restaurant chef who he worked for, so they know this world for a long time. She's the culinary producer. The showrunner is Joanna Callow, and she's worked on some incredible shows just lately, Hacks and BoJack. And you were alluding to it before. These 30-minute shows right now, the level of great emotional storytelling packed into 30 minutes, from Reservation Dogs to Hacks to Pamela Adlon and even something like Abbott Elementary. This format is just becoming peak TV. Well, do you agree?
I think so. Yeah, because, you know, at least for me, I always kind of snickered at 30-minute shows because I mostly associated them with sitcoms and things of that nature, something that was like very comedic, and I didn't really need to they were not cerebral, let's just put it that way. And so I'm like, you know, I'm essentially, you know, equating this with comedy shows and things of that nature, where, you know, quite frankly, I would say, you know, not for me, a little lesser than, you know, with the hour long shows that I was more particularly interested, things like Sopranos, The Wire, pretty much anything on HBO, essentially. But what's happening now is that because audience attention spans are so short, a lot of, and I think Barry's also benefiting from this, Hacks is another one, like you said, they are finding ways to tell these stories that usually would be done in an hour-long format, and they're doing them in such economical ways and such with such efficiency too in the runtimes of the storytelling, that they're actually packing even more of an accentuated punch. These shows are, I think, leaving a mark on people in a way that, yes, it's always going to be great to have your hour and a half long, you know, Game of Thrones episodes where they're epic and big in scope, but you can capture the same epicness, but on a human level, on a character level, in half the runtime. And I just find that to be both a daunting challenge and one that when I see it get pulled off, I'm very impressed by it.
Oh, massively, right. What did you think of episode 7, which is, it's an episode with no cuts, an uninterrupted take?
Took me a while to realize, because I was just so sucked into what was happening, that I think it was about maybe 4 minutes in, something like that. Like, and I realized, wow, they haven't cut away. And then I think by like the time we got to like the 5 minute mark or 6 minute mark, I then started to realize, oh my God, they're going to go the whole episode and you're going to do it like this. And my jaw just dropped. I leaned into my television and I was so excited to see how they were going to pull this off, because obviously the level of coordination, the rehearsal time, and just having to get this absolutely right. I mean, I can't even imagine like how many times they, you know, I'm sure they didn't shoot it that many times because it is a television schedule after all. But at the same time, I can't imagine like getting 17 minutes into it. And it's a short episode. I think it's like the shortest one of the season. I think it's only like 20 minutes, but it's the most stressful like 20 minutes that you'll ever experience. unbearable. See what you did there?
Yes.
But like, it's because it comes at a point before the finale where we know these characters well enough to be emotionally invested. So by this point in the show, when we see all the orders coming in that they can't fulfill, just everything essentially breaks down in terms of communication. Carmi is just blasting everybody. Sydney, Marcus, Richie. I was thinking we were going to see hands get thrown at some point. Like they were going to just start beating on each other.
Well, Richie does get stabbed.
Richie does get stabbed. Yeah. Intentionally or accidentally, still up to debate.
Well, I read a bit about, I mean, first of all, it's filmed, the kitchen that they have as a set is that small. And they, mm-hmm. in order to choreograph the camera behind, I mean, it was basically as it was in a kitchen, behind Chef, like a dance of coordination. I think they did it run-throughs. They did it completely 6 or 7 times, and a few times they had to stop. And every time they did it a little bit differently. Like, for example, Sydney was not quite as pissed off, I understand, a few times around. The fact that she is so intense in this one, it's such an excellent arc in her character, because at this point we're also very frustrated for her. We can't stand how Richie is treating her at this point.
No.
And that she's starting to sort of, you know, boil to use a kitchen phrase is just feels completely right here. And of course, Goodfellas, Scorsese, dolly shot through the kitchen. There's just mm-hmm. something magical about walking through a kitchen like that.
I mean, the fact that somebody told Richie to go fuck himself, I think that was Sydney who gets to tell him off in this
yes.
episode, that made me incredibly happy. I was very frustrated by Marcus in episode 7 because I get it. I understand. But at the same time, that was maybe the only bit of writing in the show where I was like, I legitimately said to myself, is this guy really that thick-headed? That lost in what he's doing? I'm sorry, but that was not the time to be working on your cake project, sir. I mean, come on. And
yeah, I think he's kind of an underdeveloped character. I mean, mm-hmm. he has one point, sort of, it's that he gets the chance to develop his art, which he hasn't really gotten before, but they
right.
sort of could have had a bit more of that. I don't know if it's been edited out or, but I know what you're saying.
I do think that there will be more to come in season 2, obviously, in that regard with him. But here, I found that to be very, very frustrating, to the point where I actually found Carmi's anger to be actually completely justifiable in that moment. However, his anger towards Sydney and what causes her to quit, I don't know if I went back and forth on this, because it's like, I know that Carmi is losing it. Like, he's clearly losing it in that moment. So I understand, like, Sydney feeling like, you know what, I'm not going to work under a guy that's going to treat me like this and be this way when, you know, the going gets rough. And in a restaurant business, it gets really, really rough. Mm-hmm. So there are going to be more days like that day. And if that's the way that, you know, if someone's going to be, then I can understand not wanting to work underneath them. But at the same time, it like I saw both sides of the argument. You know, I understood Carmi's frustration. I also understood Sydney's frustration. Do I think Sydney should have quit? No, because it doesn't last long anyway. I mean, you know, we get to the finale and, you know, it's gonna be fine, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But at the same time, I will say that, like, in terms of just those high intensity moments where the pressure is on in a restaurant setting, the people that are in charge of running those kitchens, whoever it is, either a head chef or whatever, you know, they're ruthless. They are absolutely unforgiving and ruthless. And I've actually been subject to lots of verbal abuse in those settings. Oh. So I found it to be very relatable. But at the same time, I also went back and forth on everybody's perspective of the situation and trying to, like, wrap my head around, okay, who's at fault here? Is anyone at fault here? You know, is anybody justified in how they're feeling? And I think the answer is everybody is justified. But that means then, too, that it's hard to point the finger and place
yeah.
blame.
in a way, you can also see it as it's Sydney's naivete showing itself. I mean, if she can't get this day, she has a lot, as you're saying, a lot of more days that are going to be even worse than this. So she has to sort of decide, does she want to work like this in the... And also on Carmi's end, I think that for him, everything is just caving in. Where's he going to get the money? What's going on? All these feelings that he has. He's just bailed Richie out. And I also think that he thinks that she's right. But how the hell is he going to do this in the situation, the shithole that they're in terms of money and everything?
The show does a really good job of... like a really good job of throwing problems to solve at Carmi and the other characters too, I think, on a more micro level for the other characters, but particularly Carmi, because just right when he fixes one obstacle, another one gets put in his path. And I think that, you know, you always go, you go back to like just the, you know, the silent era of cinema with stuff like, you know, Safety Last, and how conflict and tension are created by new problems that are placed in front of your protagonist to solve. And I think that this show does a really good job in a logical way. That's the point that matters, is that every problem that gets presented is a problem that is logical. They're having to deal with people that Mikey owed money to. Mm-hmm. You know, outside of the restaurant, they're having to deal with.
Yeah, he has to organize bachelor parties and kids' parties and bail his friend out, and then going to these Al-Anon meetings and dealing with his own feelings about his brother, you know, his guilt over where he was during his brother's addiction.
That's the thing, too, is that like the poor guy doesn't have time to wrestle with his own complex emotions because he's so busy being in the moment with having to solve one problem after another, that so much of what he's dealing with through the loss of his brother is it's unfinished business. He has not been able to untangle those emotions.
Well, that's what I think is also very brilliant about having this in the restaurant setting, because that's a chef can sort of hide behind that. That's what they do every day, deal with problems, make it better. New orders coming in gives you a reason to just sort of, I'll deal with my own stuff tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think Jeremy Allen White's performance throughout this entire show is really fantastic. Oh. It's not just the moments where he is frustrated and angry, or when he's repressing that anger and you can just see it simmering on his face. It's actually the moments where there's more interior character work going on, and there are these subtleties that are alluding to these unresolved emotions that he's working through that don't really come out until the finale. I mean, that 7-minute monologue that he delivers is just absolutely phenomenal. And
yeah, talk about I love
that the show, we're going back to structure here. You know, you have your penultimate episode as this technical oneer where everything just reaches a boiling point and explodes, and then your finale is more of a quieter, more introspective character piece with these really cathartic moments that really snuck up on me, especially because the tension that the show creates is so intense that to end your finale in a way where it's more of like a cool down episode, but they cool you down just enough to be able to then kind of gut punch you without you realizing it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I just found whoever broke these episodes out and wrote on a chalkboard, okay, we're going to take the audience here, and like just showing the roller coaster of emotions on like a graph. Expertly well done.
You're exactly right. All these episodes, and we've seen Carmi's, you know, dealing, and when we all of a sudden just have him straightforward 7 minutes talking about his feelings about Mikey and his guilt, it's just a gut punch.
And all because his brother just never let him work at, you know, at the restaurant.
But his brother was also a mythical figure for everyone, for Richie. I think in order to live up to that. And I think also for several of the characters to really acknowledge that he was flawed, that he had tremendous addiction problems, that money was going, I think that's also a step they have to take and realize and something they have to deal with.
Well, I think Richie is a character that parallels that, like, actually kind of brilliantly, where it's like this guy is so incredibly flawed. But then when he's at his best and he's at his moments where those flaws aren't being accentuated, you know, he's a larger than life personality. And I know so many people like that. I've been described as that, as a larger than life, you know, personality type who lights up a room anywhere he goes. And people love the infectious energy that you bring along with you. And that leaves an impression on people. And when you have like time separated as a result, you know, it goes back to that saying about people won't remember what you did or what you said, but they will remember how you made them feel. And I think that that is, you know, brought vividly to life here through Carmi and Richie and everybody's relationship with Mikey, where the flaws are all there, but this is a guy that left a very lasting impression. And now that he's gone and there are these unresolved emotions of regret, guilt, and whatever else is going on there that, you know, these characters are having to work through. And then just in a very simple sense, also just missing his presence and what a hole that is left in their lives. How do they pick up the pieces and move on from that? Very relatable, extremely relatable. Even like I don't think if you've ever experienced that, I think the show just does such a good job of detailing it out in such a way that you can find something to latch onto here. And I think that that's why the show has been very successful with critics and also anyone that watches it, is that it's emotional in a way that is very human and very relatable. You don't need to have worked in the restaurant business to understand what the characters are going through in this show.
I have some questions for you about the last scenes of here, but before we get to that, is there anything else that you wanted, or any other character you wanted to bring up that I haven't touched upon?
I will say that ever since I started watching this show, I cannot tell you like how many times I've just, you know, jokingly have said, "Yes, chef," or "Yes, hands," or whatever else they shout out in that kitchen. I think that it's so funny to me when I watch on social media anytime, like the Bears official Twitter like posts anything and all the comments are, "Hell yes, chef," or "Yes, chef." Yeah. I call you chef out of a sign of respect. And it's, yes, that's fantastic that that's something that's catching on, I think, with its fans. And you know, in terms of other characters, I do want to give a shout out. Yeah. To Liza Colon Zayas, who plays Tina.
Tina. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really, really, once again, see where I was more frustrated with Richie's character. She has a character that's also frustrating because she's got this icy exterior, very, very hard edged, and definitely does not take any shit from anybody. And yet the storytelling with her was patiently done in such a way where it was like, okay, I can tell that they're going to make her a team player and they're going to reveal more about her. And I'm actually very excited to learn more about her character in season two, because I do think that there are enough things that are subtly dropped about her character that the show doesn't fully explore in this season. But I think that we will see a deeper exploration of in season two.
It's very nicely done how she, at the beginning, she's also, like you say, like Richie, she doesn't want change. Sydney comes in and she wants her to do boil the potatoes or what it is in another way. And she, you know, is not happy with that does some things that, you know, fucks it up for Sydney. But at the same time, she starts realizing slowly that, it's never worked so well. We need this new system. And she really gets in on it. Also realize she helps us, the viewer, understand what a large figure, for example, Mikey was, because she says several times, "I miss him so much. And when he was here, this happened." I mean, you see that she has been part of this family before Mikey died, and we kind of need that as viewers. And so it's not just these two dysfunctional in the triangle that we were talking about to begin with. She really helps us to guide us that, yeah, there was something special when he was in the kitchen, and she's been there. She knows the history in a way that Sydney doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a lot of people in any job you go to, there's always going to be that seasoned veteran type, you know, the one that's weathered the storm and has seen people come and go and very much knows how to do their job and does not, like you said, like does not like change. So I like that, you know, her character started off that way. But as it went along, like I said, it whet my appetite enough to know that there's a more full course to come later on in season two. And I think that that's one of the most exciting things about the supporting characters, and also too with Jeremy Allen White in the show, is that, yes, they unpack a lot of information, and they also are able to, as I mentioned earlier, deliver a lot in this self-contained first season. But there's also so many other possibilities of where they can take the show from here, especially if they decide to open up the show more in season two. Now, I don't know if they're going to do that. They might not. They might decide to stick with having it be a contained show within the kitchen and the restaurant. And
I'm like Richie here. I'm like, I fear change. Don't open it too
much.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know which one's better here, you know, but I kind of get a sense that maybe in season two, they will open it up just a little bit more, and we will probably follow these characters, I think, a bit more and spend more time with them than we did. Because this season was really focused on Carmi, especially.
Right.
So, I mean, he's the you know, lead of the show, and it makes sense. But these other characters are just as rich and fascinating to me that I'm very, very excited and hopeful that we'll see further exploration.
Yeah, I just want to, you had such an interesting point there that both, sorry, Tina and Richie are very frustrating in different ways, mm-hmm. but you see Tina, and lots of people have been talking about this sort of toxic masculinity of the characters, or several of the characters mm-hmm. on the show, Richie. Do you think that that's sort of what makes him continue to be frustrating? And
I think that there's more screen time devoted to Richie, and there are just more instances of him just continuously screwing up, where with Tina, as you mentioned earlier, it was just simply, hey, Sydney's running the show, do what Sydney's telling you, things will be better. I can't tell you how many times I've worked in jobs where I argued, I bitched, I moaned, I put up all these reservations when new you know, agendas were put forth, and also like, you know, new company goals and things of that nature. And how are we going to achieve like these metrics? Oh man, the amount of complaining that I did. But you know what? I realized, you know, with maturity and experience, that if you just simply do as you're told and don't put up a fight, it always works out for the better. Always. You know why? Because if the plan fails, you did it. So they'll realize that the plan was a failure. And if it works, then everybody wins. So it's like,
Matt, though, when I just intercede, it works, but not if you're writing a show. We need that. I mean, if Richie would have just episode one been, yes, this sounds perfect, let's change everything.
I agree. Like you said, you don't want to eliminate conflict that gets brought up because of that. I do think, though, with Richie, I think they went a little overboard with him, is I guess what I'm saying. Where with Tina, I thought it was just the right amount.
No, I respect that. I have to say, I think he's a fascinating character that we've seen in several frustrating brothers and relatives in history of narrative. I think he's just another addition to that iconic character. I think he's really interesting in all his frustrating glory. But let's talk about, so the last episode, what happens here is that Richie gives Carmi the note that Carmi has not found or seen, that he thinks that Mikey hasn't left anything behind for him, but he has.
Right.
He sits alone and he reads the note, and the note you know, gives him the satisfaction of that he is proud of him in one small sentence. And on the other side, there's that the recipe for this really simple pasta, onions, and very specifically the small cans of tomato. And Carmi decides to cook this for the family meal that they call when all the when they eat together, the restaurant staff. Right. And when they start opening these cans, they find huge amounts of money. I wanted to ask you a little bit about what is your, how did you see this? What was this money? Was it money that he owed Uncle Cicero, or?
That's what I interpreted it as. You know, there's all this talk about money, that misplaced money and mismanagement of the funds that have led the restaurant to get to the point that it's at. And so I just always assumed that that was the money that was owed to Oliver Platt's character, Cicero, and that.
But why didn't he give it to him?
That's what that's something that I am. Yeah. Like, I understand that that part of it is not necessarily resolved. You know, and it could be as simple as.
Well, he didn't want to give it to him.
Mikey comes into this money. He's got this money. He wants to leave it now to. He wants to leave it now to his brother, you know what I mean? And fuck this other guy. I don't know. Maybe it is as simple as that. Something tells me that that will be further explored in the second season, I think, because I do think it is a little open to debate right now. Mm-hmm. But I naturally assumed that, that was that money that was owed to him.
It's a wonderfully satisfying scene. I mean, you're just... The thing that I kept thinking of was that I had this feeling that Mikey knew that he wouldn't be able to handle this. But instead of, if he would have given the money directly to Cicero, it would have given Carmi no chance to do something new with this restaurant.
Do you think that because of his, I just realized something. Do you think because of his drug addiction, do you think that maybe he was using the money to sell, buy drugs, and then like laundering the money through the restaurant?
It was my first thought that this had something to do with drug, he and Richie's sort of drug money. But then
Richie would be able to, you know, explain that if that were the case.
Yes.
I would imagine.
That's a little open-ended for me. I mean, even though it's very story-wise sort of magically satisfying to have this ending, when I started thinking about it, I wasn't really sure what the motivation was for him to put it in the tomatoes.
I just don't understand then. Do you think maybe he intended to pay back Cicero and he just died before he could do it? But that doesn't make sense then, because then why go through the trouble of like putting them into these cans?
That takes a lot of work.
I almost wonder if like he used the money as a loan, and then any money that the restaurant was making, it has to be connected back to, you know, his drug addiction somehow and something else that he was probably doing. I almost wonder if like all that money in the can was kind of like a money under the mattress sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like you just have it there for a rainy day in case of things like go haywire. Also, too, I also wonder if it was placed in such a space because, you know, if there is illegal activity and the place were to ever get raided by the authorities. Do you think the authorities will be smart enough to open up all these cans of tomatoes to find any kind of stolen drug money? Mm. You know what I mean? So yes. I wonder if that's also an element of it too.
Right, right. No, but do you think that this will be something they bring into season two, or do you feel that the creators are like, this was a satisfactory ending and we don't need to explain
this? I definitely think that they feel like they lucked out in terms of finding this money. I think they're going to use it. And then they're going to find out where this money came from, and it's going to create new problems for them.
Yeah, because when Carmi and them start using it, now that they've closed the restaurant and are starting something new, Oliver Platt is certainly going to say, where did you get all this money from?
Exactly, yep.
Immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't seem like he's waiting around for anything.
I also want to know, like, how the hell did he get him in the cans? Just so much work. Why?
So much work. Well, he obviously didn't want to pay Cicero.
Right.
As you said, then there would have been no options. He would have had nothing. They couldn't have done anything. I think he wants Carmi to keep the restaurant.
Right. But then where was all the money the restaurant was then making? Where was all that going? It's definitely something that is there to create a nice moment for everybody at the end. It's a great reveal. It's really, really fantastic.
Right.
It leads into, you know, them announcing that the restaurant is going to be repackaged and reopened and retitled as The Bear, which, love it. Mm-hmm. Great way to tie everything together at the very, very end. But I do think it's intentionally left open to debate because it is going to probably be the central driving plot point of any and all of the conflict, I think, that comes from season two.
Well, maybe the listeners can, if you guys have any thoughts, I'd be so interested in hearing everyone else's take on this. So, Matt, I want to end with, you're the awards expert. What do you think? How will this show fare come next? Because it won't be this Emmys, of course. It'll be
That's a little tough here because it's a new show. It's a small show. And they're going to have to, I think, give a really robust campaign to it in order to keep it in the conversation. I mean, we have seen shows premiere early, and I mean like a year early, and go on to, you know, make it a year later. It has happened before. So it's not unprecedented, but this is also not like one of those shows like on the level of a Stranger Things or a Game of Thrones where the budget is so big. It's like one of those too big to ignore kind of shows. However, it is definitely, I think, so far, like the best new show I've seen this year. And it's also one that I think is going to resonate and stand out to people when we get to that point. So I'm hopeful that it will be able to go to distance and get into categories like best drama. Also, you know, I would love to see the editing get recognized, the direction, the sound work, members of the cast. I feel, though, like deep down, I do think it's not going to be like one of those across the board shows where it gets in everywhere. And I think maybe for like the first season, you know, I think it might be one of those shows where it's so good and it takes the Television Academy some time to catch up with
like
it.
Like Reservation Dogs.
Yeah, but also too, like something like The Americans, I look back on and I think about a lot, you know, and it's like some shows, they take their time and, you know, they're distracted by some other things and eventually they get around to it. But, you know, I could see writing. I could see a directing nomination. I could see like the editing nomination. I don't know if it gets into drama series. I don't know if Jeremy Allen White gets into actor. I mean, I'm being very conservative. Do I think all of the members of the cast and every element of this show deserves to get there? Absolutely. And I know I would be voting for it if I had the power to do so. But I don't know. With new shows, it's really tough. It's not always a slam dunk.
Well, we'll see. It did premiere really early because it premiered sort of while everyone was talking about this year's Emmys. Mm-hmm. So it sort of...
I mean, if it can do as well as something like, you know, Mr. Robot did, like with its first season, where it got into drama series, Rami Malek was nominated for lead actor, got into writing. If it can manage to get a drama series nomination, then I think we're looking at a scenario or two where maybe it even picks up a win for something. You know, it could be that. It could be one of those shows that, you know, does that first season, just makes a big splash. I mean, it's a heart attack of a show, truly.
Oh, God.
And not because of the food.
No, it's a little bit because of the food, but mostly because of the tension. This was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure.
Thanks so much to Matt Neglia. Follow him on Next Best Picture. And thank you so much for joining us. You can subscribe to Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.
I'm Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. they were able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcasts.